Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role does art play in your life, and what role does the federal funding play in your art? While the National Endowment for the Arts was established during the Johnson administration, the government has been patronizing artists since the early 19th century, when lawmakers commissioned some oil paintings to decorate the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C. Since then, the primary conflict related to federal arts funding hasn't been whether to do it or even what sort of art to pay for. Instead, my guest today will explain the question boils down to whether federal arts dollars are intended to benefit individual artists or the rest of us who might interact with their works. David A. Smith teaches American history at Baylor University. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So we have this fundamental question. Are federal arts programs designed to benefit the I or the we? Can you explain that?
Well, the way I look at that and the way I think about that when I described it that way, the I is the individual artist working in a studio, working in composition, working in whatever field he or she works in, and seeing the art that is produced primarily as a personal expression. And that's the I. And the artist who works this way and thinks this way understands that which is produced to be an irreducible personal expression of something that's unique to himself or to herself, that people can benefit from or not benefit from. The we in that equation is the public at large. And my idea is that art that concentrates solely on one element or the other isn't really art. You need both sides. You need the creator and you need the perceiver. You need the communal aspect of it. And the we speaks to the communal aspect of art and the community in which it exists, without which it remains sort of just personal expression, and it doesn't sort of take that step beyond that to become art.
And I guess, as you say, it really does sort of fall somewhere in the middle, in that one person's individual art might in fact represent the great tide of American sentiment or values.
Mm-hmm. It's tough. It's one of these things that you can make a good case for both sides. And in a way, you have to make a good case for both sides before you can sort of move forward with the argument about public funding. And you can't have public funding of the arts that concentrates just on one or the other, but at the same time, there has to be a purpose in mind, or you get sort of just a muddled program.
Aside from the question of whether or not we believe that it's valuable to have public funding of the arts, is it in fact indispensable?
Is public funding of the arts indispensable? That's a good question. Well, I'm not sure that it's indispensable. It's one of those things that's a civic good, but at the same time, if public funding of the arts undermines the good that public art can do, it might be better not to have it. If the result of public spending on the arts is controversy and disgust and, worst of all, an erosion of the conviction that art is a civic responsibility, then it's better off not to do it, because the casualty of a public role for the arts is too great to bear. I mean, if you lose that, if you lose the community sense that art is important in a civic sense, it would be better not to fund it and just let private sources fund it.
Yeah. Should artists who want to push the envelope and to sort of shock people, should they automatically sort of want to turn down NEA funding, do you think?
Well, I would imagine that it's hard for an artist to turn down funding from wherever it comes. But my sense is everybody might be better served for that, with the exception perhaps of the artist who is going to get publicity from it, and publicity helps.
So politicians for centuries have been patronizing artists, whether or not they did it with public funding or their own funding and sort of gave it to the public. Can you talk a little bit about how we decided as a country that this was something that we wanted to do in a formal way?
It's something that began in a way in the Great Depression with the public art programs of the Great Depression, the WPA, the PWAP, things like that. And what came out of that was an awareness on the part of artists that the government knew that they existed. And those programs, however, came to an end when prosperity returned. The WPA arts program came to an end in 43. But what it created, in a sense, what those programs created, was this sense on the part of artists that they could have the government's ear if they organized. Now, in the 1950s, this was a key decade. In the 1950s, there came to be some very overt concerns about American culture. Two reasons. Number one, the materialism of American culture in the 50s, the abundance, the prosperity, and people began to be concerned that that sort of material abundance eroded the character of the American soul. And the other thing that happened, especially in the wake of Sputnik, was that there was a great pressure on American education to go more in the direction of math and science and create engineers and mathematicians and things like that. And that was seen as a laudable goal, but one that if it stripped away the cultural side of education, there could be some bad effects. And one who was really worried about this was President Eisenhower. It goes against most people's image of Ike, but he was really worried about the materialism of the country and the prosperity of the country that eroded people's soul. And he was really worried about propaganda from the Soviet Union that painted, as he said, the American people as a race of materialistic, gum-chewing barbarians. And he thought that the arts, therefore, were a valid concern of the government. Now, and in 1955, he said in his State of the Union address, we should have a National Council on the Arts to sort of steer government arts programs and what the government could do for the arts. It wasn't an endowment. It wasn't any sort of spending. And Eisenhower thought that you could have a valid and well-expressed governmental concern for the arts without spending on it. And apparently a lot of people disagreed with that. And this sort of builds and builds and ebbs and flows. But in Congress, there are always, in the Senate and in the House, there are always this core of – there's always this core who want to do this. And finally, it takes the Johnson administration and the Great Society – to put this into play, and he creates the National Council for the Arts, and in the fall of 65, he creates the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities that gives the council money to make grants. But the key element, I think, to understand the genesis of the NEA is to see it in the context of the Great Society and this belief that it's a societal good. You know, just like every other program of the Great Society, the goal is not to pull society apart, but to lift all parts of society up. And Johnson thought the arts and humanities played a vital role in that.
Was the understanding at that point that goal for 1965 would be the goal for the foreseeable future of the NEA?
I think so. The one problem with that is that you've got a National Council on the Arts made up of artists, and you've got politicians creating this, and to use the formulation that we talked about earlier, the artists always sort of drift in the direction of the eye and the individual artist, and the politicians see it as a civic public good, and they drift in the direction of the we. And the notion is the National Endowment for the Arts capable of serving both the interests of the artists and the public at large simultaneously? And if not, where do you finally make the decision?
What kinds of limitations are placed on artists who receive NEA funding, if any?
Now?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't do individual grants anymore. In the wake of the big scandals of the early 1990s, Congress took away the endowment's ability to give individual grants to practicing artists.
The money goes to organizations.
It goes to organizations now. Mm-hmm. So they've sort of steered away from that troublemaking arrangement altogether.
And those organizations might, in fact, fund the same artists that the government didn't want to fund directly.
It's possible, but at the same time, you had up through the court system this court case coming up from a group of performance artists called the NEA4 that charged that content restrictions that the endowment created were unconstitutional. And it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in 1998, in an 8-1 decision, the Supreme Court said content restrictions are not unconstitutional, and they're perfectly fine if the endowment wants to do this.
Because they have the First Amendment right to express themselves, they just don't necessarily earn a federal paycheck to do it.
Right, exactly. One of the justices said they can go off and enrage the people as much as they want to, they just don't need to expect the people to pay for it.
Are the arts today more bureaucratized, if that's the right word, than they were before these changes were made?
Well, in a sense, you could say what isn't bureaucratized these days, but not really. I mean, I don't think so. And you've still got the arts existing primarily at the local level. And local level arts organizations, you know, think of theaters here in Dallas and the symphonies and things like that, they have staff and their own little tiny bureaucracies, but not in a government way. And the NEA itself has remained relatively streamlined.
So who's in a position to be an arbiter of what's appropriate art and good art in the system that we have right now, where the NEA funds organizations?
An arbiter of what's appropriate. Probably you see that at the local level, but at the same time, the National Council on the Arts is the body that passes judgment on these things, passes judgment on these grant applications. The grant applications go to the endowment, and they go to specialized bodies and boards within the endowment, and then they sort of bubble up through the council and then to the chairman. And it's built in a way now that the purpose of a lot of these grants tends to be what I would sort of call arts evangelism, you know, spreading the word about art and trying to make people more familiar with the arts rather than on its specific creation, especially in the visual arts. And that has worked pretty well to sort of, I guess you could say, weed potential controversies out before they get too high in the system. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So if we are now sort of working through the NEA largely to evangelize, as you said, and get people, you know, people in the seats at theaters and people walking in the doors of museums, is there a danger, do you think, of sort of calcifying our taste around something that's already been created and deemed appropriate, as opposed to continuing to use the arts as something that is evolving and growing and changing with the culture?
Yes, I can see that. But I would respond to that by saying the amount of federal funding in any arts organization budget isn't really the bulk of it. And the NEA has a pretty small budget, really, and it can only do so much, and it tries to spread its money around pretty equally.
How much are we spending?
Let's see, $155 million was
nationwide.
On the arts. And the Obama administration requested, I believe, $161 million. House subcommittee bumped that up to $170, which would still be short of what it peaked at back in the mid-90s. But in a sense of whether or not that would calcify tastes, I don't think there's enough money being spent by the National Endowment to calcify tastes. And I can't imagine that they could spend they'd ever get enough money to calcify tastes. What they can do with judicious spending, I believe, is to get more people interested in the arts, specifically at an earlier age. And they just released a report just last week, I think, the NEA did, that said that arts audiences across every type of art, they're falling, and they're getting older and they're falling off. And that's a concern that they need to address before they address any sort of creativity concerns, I believe.
David A. Smith is my guest. He teaches American history at Baylor University. We're talking today about his new book, Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. You can join the discussion now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Baylor University history professor David A. Smith. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. You can find the book in bookstores. There is also an essay related to it on the Art and Seek page of KERA's website. If you would like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Let us know what you think. David, do broad benefits of NEA funding require that NEA-funded projects have broad appeal?
Not necessarily. You can't worry about – you can't try to engineer an appeal that's too broad because then you start to water things down too much. You know, the culture at large is sort of inertia-wise resistant to anything that's too difficult. So you have to sort of administer it in small doses. And if you worry about too broad an appeal, it's really as bad as going with too narrow of an appeal. You've sort of got to hit the middle, and that's incredibly difficult.
I was really surprised to read, this is a little bit of trivia, about Richard Nixon's role with the NEA. Mm-hmm. He has sort of a singular position in terms of having supported his work.
Right. It's under the Nixon administration that the NEA really becomes a more permanent organization. When he came in, the budget, I believe, was about $8.5 million a year. And when he left, I think it was close to 60. And he picked as his NEA head a very energetic and diplomatic woman named Nancy Hanks. And she wanted the NEA to have more money so it could undertake bigger programs aimed at things like museums and symphonies, rather than individual artists. And actually, under her administration, when Hanks was head of the NEA, the council had a good bit of fighting over this. Just within the council itself, there was uncertainty over where the money should be going, whether to individual artists or to institutions. And Nixon thought in this way a lot like LBJ did. Maybe even more so because the Vietnam era was tearing the country apart more when the Nixon administration came in than in 65. And Nixon was really looking at something to offset the cultural fraying that he saw happening. And he thought that endowment for the arts could help that.
How do the initiatives of the NEA tend to sort of change and evolve according to who's in power politically in the White House and in Congress?
Not really. There's not a whole lot of relationship there that I've seen, because the NEA, year in and year out, up until the 90s, pretty much got bigger budgets. There was a little bit of a cutback in the 80s, but within a couple of years, it was more than it had been. I mean, it doesn't matter a whole lot whether there's a Republican in the White House. I'm thinking of Nixon and Ford, Reagan even. Or a Democrat in the White House. What does happen? I've noticed the press seems to think that Democrats do more for the arts. Even Carter. And when Carter came in, when Carter campaigned, the artists of the country really weren't behind him, and he had cut the budget of the Georgia State Council for the Arts. And by and large, people were suspicious of what Carter may do. This was in the campaign of 76. And then he gets in the White House. And the next thing you know, we're having a cultural renaissance, and he's said to be engrossed in poetry and listen to opera for 8 hours a day. But there isn't really much difference between a Republican administration and a Democratic administration as far as the vibrancy of the NEA goes. The only thing that has affected it was those huge scandals back in the late 80s, early 90s. And then following on the heels of those scandals, the Republican sort of takeover of the House in 94.
This is the works by Mapplethorpe and Serrano that mm-hmm. offended so many people.
Exactly.
Were they receiving direct grants from the NEA?
No, they received indirect grants. The Mapplethorpe dust-up came about because a Philadelphia museum put together a very large retrospective of Mapplethorpe's works, and they got about $30,000 from the NEA to do that. The Serrano bit actually started first. And there was an organization in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, called the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, and they got money each year to basically hold a contest. And they gave awards, And Serrano got one of their awards. And in getting an award, he got some money, and they put together a touring exhibition partly funded by NEA money. And then that's how that came about.
We have an email here from Joe in Dallas, a KERA member, who says, without the individual, there is no art. At this time, it is very difficult to get sponsorship from many organizations. Most are concerned with their own survival. Consequently, they're not very interested in anything unknown. I believe the grants to individuals in art should be restored. A lot of people feel like Joe does.
Oh, sure. Very much so. And they can make a good case for it. I mean, that's the richness of this debate. Both sides are right in it. And with politics, you know, it's so much the case that you have to sort of make a choice between two good alternatives.
A lot of people will remember that the NEA threw its unfettered support behind the Obama campaign in the last election. What did he have to say that was so appealing to them?
Well, not much really of substance that I saw or heard, rather. But the people who rallied behind him were the ones that gave his administration or his potential administration sort of a gloss of artistic patronage. And you know, we'll see. He's got a new NEA head waiting in the wings. He's made his decision for that, and we'll see how that goes and see if the new NEA head lobbies to restore individual grants. He may or may not. He's a savvy businessman.
This is Rocco Landisman.
Rocco Landisman, right. And I was on a radio show last week and went back and forth with someone who thought that he would make a lot of difference. And I'm not entirely sure. I could be wrong, but I don't think he will, but he might.
Does an NEA director who tries to rock the boat essentially shoot himself or herself in the foot?
See, that's the thing, yeah. I think that if an NEA director, if he came in and tried to change things too much, you're going to run into congressional resistance. Because Congress, as long as this agency is quiet, Congress is not going to pay attention to it. But if the boat starts rocking, there are going to be people in Congress who pay attention to it. And that, in the long run, might make higher budgets more difficult.
How does the NEA make decisions about the money that it spends in terms of geography? Because if you live in a big city like New York or San Francisco or Chicago or even Dallas mm-hmm. nowadays, you have a lot more access automatically than you do in a place like Waco.
Right. Well, this is a question that the NEA has wrestled with for a long time. And even before the NEA was created, there was a great deal of pressure and interest in Congress on this very question of geographic distribution. And even then, I'm thinking in the late 50s and early 60s, before the endowment started operating, you had representatives and senators from New York, Illinois, California, representing New York and Chicago and San Francisco, Los Angeles, saying that most arts organizations are here in these cities, and that's where the money's going to wind up going. But then you had all these other people from Iowa and Kansas and, you know, middle America saying it's not fair if the national government spends money in a way on the arts that's not nationally distributed. And you had this geographic fuss that went on all throughout the debate whether or not to do this in the first place. And one person, one arts executive testified, you know, in favor of creating an endowment, and he said, we need a covered wagon of culture to take the arts to every last horizon. And I think there's a great deal of appeal in that, especially for senators and representatives not from these, you know, cultural centers. It wasn't the case until the administration of Dana Gioia at the NEA, however, that the NEA really spread its money, if not equally, at least very, very broadly. He said that under his leadership, every congressional district in the country got some NEA funds. And he could go into any congressman or congresswoman's office on the Hill and say, this is what we're doing in your district to help your constituents, you know, with traveling Shakespearean companies or whatever. And that's the first time, he's the first one that I think actually made that sort of wide geographic distribution of these dollars themselves crucial to the NEA's mission.
Analyze that choice for me, though. Do you think that Dana Gioia was trying to make sure that there were arts in every small town in America, or was he trying to make sure that the NEA continued to have money at a time when people were questioning whether or not it was a necessary organization?
I think it was a little of both, actually. You know, he first came to prominence with an essay he wrote back in 1991. It was in The Atlantic. It was called Can Poetry Matter? And he's a poet. And his whole idea was that poetry as an art form had pretty much sealed itself off willfully from the public. And you had an art in which there were people writing poetry that was read only by other poets. And he thought that was just nuts, basically, because poetry, in his understanding, had this very rich tradition going back into the 19th century of speaking to the public at large. And I think he believed that the arts in general were trending in that direction too. And I think he's right, especially since the 70s, especially with the visual arts, you've got so much going on and sort of a closed conversation. But what he was interested in was making people aware that the arts mattered. And to the extent that these conversations about the arts were closed and funding was narrow, people didn't understand it. And this goes hand in hand with his carrying out all these different studies about the health of reading, the health of drama, the health of the arts in general in contemporary society. But at the same time, you're right, he's a savvy businessman, and he knows that if he goes into a congressman's office and says, here's what we're doing in your district, he's going to have the wind at his back.
David A. Smith is my guest. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Lee, who writes, can you comment on the line between art versus craft, especially in funding artists? When is someone an artist versus a craftsperson?
That's tricky. That's really tricky. And the NEA had a little bit of a trouble with this back in the 70s when Carter was president and Walter Mondale, the vice president's wife, Joan, was regarded as sort of the first lady of the arts in the administration. And she was interested in crafts. And that's a prickly question, you know, because you've got these definitions of art that symphonies and oil paintings or whatever, and where does basket weaving come in? You know, it's artistic, but is it art? And I'm very reluctant to draw a hard and fast line, but at the same time, a line sort of has to be drawn. You know, everything can't be art, or art won't be anything. And you have to have a discriminating attitude, not out of any sort of bitterness toward a form or another, but almost to preserve the sanctity of what art is.
Does NEA money serve as a sort of seed for private investment in the arts? Is there any evidence of that?
Yeah, it really does. An NEA dollar will sometimes generate as much as three other dollars. They started this program called Challenge Grants, the endowment.
We know about those here at Public Radio.
Exactly, yeah. And it was shown pretty well that an NEA grant stimulates a great deal more giving. So if, you know, you get an NEA grant of $250, you're liable to have $1,000 before you know it. It really is. But at the same time, there's a danger in this, because that additional giving comes from the fact that the NEA initial grant at some level at least connotates a seal of approval. And if you get an art that is overtly political, you run the risk of the endowment being associated with that political statement more so than the art itself. And this is one of the problems with political art. It drags politics into it. And when you've got money involved, it's trouble.
How are NEA funds divided between different forms of art, visual arts and theater and dance and things like that?
Well, they used to have grants of those very titles. You know, they had grants for the dance. They had grants for theater. They had grants for visual arts. They had grants for sculpture. Their grant titles now, their grant classifications now, are much more bureaucratic sounding. And I can't get them exactly right because they're not on the top of my head. But access and preservation is one of their grant types now.
That sounds like museums to me.
Yeah, or any sort of agency that wants to preserve, or you could get an access and preservation grant if you were a symphony who wanted to go out and play concerts for young people, or a theater group or something like that. Or it's that way now. The grants are awarded, how about this? The grants are awarded more now by what the purpose of the enterprise is. If the purpose of this activity is to bring in more audiences, well, there's sort of a grant classification for that, rather than for painting or for dance or for opera or anything like that. There are a few that are still there. There's a jazz master's program that pretty much acknowledges the contributions of the fundamental figures in American jazz. There's an opera program that's very similar to that. But most of all, the grants speak to the mission rather than that which is created.
Does the NEA still rely on people that would be considered elites to make decisions about where the money goes and what's important for the American people to consume?
Wow. I think just what a loaded word, you know. By virtue of the fact that there are a few people doing it, yes, they are elite. Whether they are elitists is another thing entirely. But really, I remember there's a New York Times reporter back in the 90s that got really worked up about a pejorative use of the word elite and said, you know, what's wrong with elite when it comes to the arts? Because we want the best. We don't want to fund mediocrity. And that's a great chasm of difficulty there. Because elite in a democracy, in an egalitarian democracy, elite is such a loaded word. But for the arts, elite is such a key concept. That's where the tangled web between art and politics in a democracy comes out, because you're dealing with populism and elitism at the same time, and they don't mix very well.
David A. Smith is a history professor at Baylor University. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. We would love to know what you think. You can let us know by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour teaches American history at Baylor University. His name is David A. Smith. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. David, do you think that the culture wars have sort of fallen off as a point of conflict in this country?
They've certainly waned. You don't hear about it as much. But I think that you've got such a diverse country, you're always going to have flashpoints that boil down to differences in the direction of the culture and in cultural expression.
When they were raging, did we overestimate the power and the impact and the reach of the National Endowment for the Arts?
Was the controversy testament to the arts having a long reach, or the endowment having a long reach?
The endowment. In other words, so much of it focused on whether NEA should pay for these things. And when you describe the budget as $161 million potentially next year, that doesn't seem like, you know, a fraction of what's spent on the arts.
Right. The controversies, what they did, they served to magnify the role of the arts endowment. And the arts endowment sort of stood in for the culture as a whole, you know, in the direction of the government and things like this. The culture wars and the whole thing about Serrano and Mapplethorpe and that whole bit, it did serve to make the NEA look sort of a lot bigger than it was. And I think that was sort of a mistake, because the bigger the NEA looked, the more damage it was perceived to be able to do within the culture wars if it continued in a certain way. I mean, if the NEA was as influential as its bitterest detractors thought it was, you know, it would have had a trillion-dollar budget. But that's something that's very important, and I think that's something that the head of the NEA needs to remember, that controversy will magnify the influence of the endowment in a bad way.
There's been talk bandied about now for some time that there ought to be a cabinet-level position dedicated to the arts. Do you think if the budget didn't change substantially, would that really make a difference one way or another?
Frankly, I don't think it would make a difference at all. I don't think that having a cabinet-level post, a secretary of the arts and culture or whatever, I don't think it would make much of a difference at all. The NEA does what it does very well. And I had written about this in other places. Having a secretary of the arts, having a cabinet-level post, would, I believe, send the message that the arts were capable of being centralized in a way that they're not. You know, we have a Department of the Treasury because that which Treasury does can't be done any other way. And we have a Department of State because the foreign relations of the country demand the sort of centralization that a cabinet-level post creates. And the arts and culture don't need that.
Do you know if the NEA has a formal relationship with the Department of Education?
I don't think it does. I mean, there may be some ties in there, but I don't think it does. That goes to a problem in and of itself. You know, back when this talk of a cabinet-level position was being bandied about, this was back in January, one of the people who was pushing hardest for that was producer Quincy Jones. And what he said really set him off was the abysmal state of arts education in students that he met. You know, students not knowing who Louis Armstrong was or anything like that. And he's right on about that. The arts are arts education is dismal in the country. But what I was thinking is that if you take arts education out of the Department of Education and put it somewhere else, even if it's in a Department of Fine Arts, what you're saying is that arts education is something other than education. You're sort of demoting it by removing it from the concern of the government body that's designed to champion education in the first place.
We have an email here from Paul in Fort Worth who asks that you address a conservative religion's influence on art funding.
Conservative religion's influence on art funding. Well, it is the case that the Serrano dust-up was...
We won't mention it by name, but you can describe it.
Exactly, the work itself. It was religious in theme, and it came to the attention of a activist preacher in, I believe, Alabama. And it was seen by people of various faiths, not, you know, Catholic, Protestant, various denominations, I should say, as offensive. And in that way, conservative religious tastes did – well, they were the ones that were most outraged by it. And any time you get conservative tastes or liberal tastes that are hotly held, they're the most easily outraged over something. So it's not that conservative religion really played a role in the endowment or anything like that. It's just that it so happened that the endowment money went to something that inflamed conservative religious sentiments. And not even overly conservative ones. Even moderate religious sentiments were inflamed by it, rather. And you have to – I mean, we've got a diverse country. And we've got a country full of people that are outraged rather easily on both sides of the spectrum.
Well, and it's interesting because I think that work in particular really put the argument point at maybe a much farther degree than it would have been. I think people came to the defense of that work who didn't necessarily like it themselves but felt like decrying it would threaten the freedom of all artists to work and to express themselves however they saw fit.
Mm-hmm. I think there was the danger in that perception. Whereas the people who were most worked up about it, all they wanted to threaten was government funding of art that did that. And, you know, if Andres Serrano or whomever wanted to do things in that way or anything else, fine, they could do it, but not with government funding.
We have an email here from Brad who asks whether arts funding might interfere with the bottom-up nature of art.
Art funding interfering with the bottom-up nature of art. Well, perhaps, but the bottom-up nature of art isn't always a necessary thing. I mean, art can come from the top just as much as it can come from the bottom. You know, Leonard Bernstein could have picked up his pen and written something else, and it would have been great rather than having to sort of bubble up from the grassroots. You know, when you bubble up from the grassroots, you bring a lot of grass and leaves with you.
Should the NEA think about funding things that are much more popular forms of art, or are those things automatically going to be supported because people are willing to pay for them?
I think the latter, yeah. I don't think the NEA has any business dabbling in popular culture because popular culture can take care of itself. You know, what can't take care of itself is fine art in the face of popular culture. I mean, popular culture is, you know, it chews up everything. It uses everything and debases everything in a sense. And there's no need to defend or to fund popular culture because it takes care of itself amply.
How does arts funding in the United States compare with other Western democratic countries?
Well, that's a tricky question. Overall, the public spending on art in the United States is a lot higher than in other countries. And the United States has a lot of legislation in place, tax laws and things, that give huge breaks to the arts. If you figure everything together, the United States spends an enormous amount of money on the arts. And the United States government, through tax breaks especially, spends an awful lot of money on the arts. Other countries do give more money to the arts in a strictly, you know, dollar sense. But at the same time, the United States more than makes up for that with tax law and individual contributions. There was an article I saw, I think it was in D Magazine. It was some comments that the daughter of the DSO conductor made. And she said that in the United States, the people of a city take a much greater role in the arts than they do in Europe, than she was used to, because it's theirs. The people of Dallas have a personal investment, you know, in the DSO that apparently took her, you know, by surprise a little bit. At least it arrested her attention enough to say that people in the United States feel more ownership and responsibility for their institutions of higher culture than they do in Europe.
If you were setting guidelines for the NEA and how it would choose to invest its money in the arts across the country, what do you think would be the most important things from even the perspective of a historian?
What I believe is that the NEA should do all it can to make the arts a greater part of people's lives. Now, however it does that, I don't know. But the most crucial element is that we don't let the audiences for the fine arts die out, you know. And you mentioned popular culture, and it's omnivorous. It eats everything. And the audiences for the symphony and the ballet and live theater, you know, except for Broadway and musical theater, that sort of stands apart. But what the NEA would best be doing, in my opinion, is taking on itself the sort of the nurturing of interest in the coming generations, so the arts will always have a body of supporters.
So the planning should be long-term as opposed to the next couple of years.
I think so. That's a good way of putting it.
Do you think that we're becoming a more artistically sophisticated people?
I don't see any sign of that. Do you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've had NEA funding now mm-hmm. for 30 years.
Right. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder if the NEA is sort of fighting a rear guard action against popular culture, you know, in the name of high art. And if that's what it's doing, you know, bully for it and more power to it. But it's probably the case that more people are going to the museum these days than they used to. Maybe more people are going to the symphony. More people are going. More people aren't going to opera. More people aren't going to ballet. I don't know if more people are going to live theater. And I don't know if a love for these arts expressions, I don't know if they're stronger than they were 40 years ago. And that's a concern.
Well, it's interesting, and I guess it causes you to at least ask the question of whether the NEA has been sort of an experiment that hasn't yielded the results that it was meant to. Because there's no way to really measure the evidence that the NEA has affected.
That's very good. You know, a lot of people seek to compare the Arts Endowment to the National Science Foundation. And we give money to science projects, and we give money to this, and we give money to scientists, and they do this experiment. But you're touching right on the exact reason why science funding and arts funding are not the same thing. You know, it's apples and oranges. You can't really measure success in the arts, at least in terms of personal expression, like you can in individual science experiments. And you know, whether the arts are more healthy, you know, in 2009 than they were in 1965, I honestly don't know. I mean, more people in terms of numbers are probably going to the museums, you know, but is high art a more prominent player in the lives of individuals at the same time? I don't know.
And I guess there's also the question of whether or not high art is ultimately more valuable than, I don't mean absolute popular culture, but the things that people go to without having to be inspired by the NEA.
There's a timelessness in the greatest expressions of art that needs to be attended to. Great art has the power to draw us outside of ourselves, make us less self-centered. And that's why art is so civically important in a democracy. You know, a democracy full of self-centered individuals doesn't work very well. Great art and contact with great art is one thing that reminds us each of our common humanity. That's sort of a measure of the greatness of art. You know, look at a Rembrandt from 400 years ago or 350 years ago or whatever, and there's a spark in it, or in a Vermeer. I'm thinking about the Dutch masters because I've been reading about them. And there's a spark there that often you can't see in popular culture.
In about 20 seconds that we have left, did you have a favorite character that emerged for you in doing all this research?
Gosh, that's a good question. Nancy Hanks was a heck of a person, and she really was energetic, and I liked her a lot. And she, I felt a great deal of admiration for her, especially in the way that she stood up to the Council on the Arts and wanting to take the arts to a broader public.
David A. Smith teaches American history at Baylor University. His new book is called Money for Art, The Tangled Web of Art and Politics in American Democracy. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.